This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today, reaction to Australia's plans to upgrade a strategically important wharf in Papua New Guinea on Manus Island. Also coming up, PNG authorities raise concerns about a troubling practice that they say is becoming more common by the day.
It's a trend, increasing trend in sale of children. Particularly the cause of it is rural urban migration and also unexpected pregnancies. Yeah.
And why not everyone is backing the experiment that's currently trying to clean up what's known as the Great Pacific Garbage Patch.
It's not going to capture the microplastics. And that's where I would argue the majority of the harm is coming from, through ingestion of these microparticles.
We're going to have more on that story and much more coming up here on Pacific Beat. Good morning, I'm Catherine Grau. First, though, a former PNG Defence Force commander says that there needs to be more debate within the public over an increased Australian military presence in Papua New Guinea. Now, Australia is set to strengthen its commitment to regional maritime security with the announcement of a $5 million investment in PNG's Lombrum Naval Base on Manus Island. The Australian government made the announcement of the wharf upgrade at the weekend after much speculation on the deal within Australian media. And it comes in the wake of news that Australia is also planning short-term troop deployments to PNG. Now, the former PNG Defence Commander, Major General Jerry Singerock, has told local media MTV News that he has reservations about the latest partnership between Australia and PNG, fearing it could threaten PNG's sovereignty.
This is Papua New Guinea. We are a sovereign country, and we have our own 200 miles EEZ. We have our own land border to look after. We have our airspace to look after. So for it to exert its military in Papua New Guinea, it must consult.
Jerry Singerock also says there needs to be public debate before PNG allows Australia to get involved in its military bases.
If Australia at the moment is thinking of establishing a base or a series of bases in Papua New Guinea and getting involved physically, then it's called for a public debate. And at the moment, there's absence of public debate, let alone the absence of debate on the floor of Parliament, because that's a strategic move.
That's Jerry Singerock. Now, I should say, at the moment, Australia has just announced that it's going to upgrade the wharf and also shore-based infrastructure at the Lombrum Naval Base on Manus Island. It hasn't given much more detail than that, but the Australia's Shadow Defence Minister, Richard Marle, so he's a spokesman for Labor, says he also has concerns about the needs of PNG being forgotten in this particular deal that's been announced.
What is actually best for the countries themselves? It's not so much about China in the Pacific. It needs to be about Australia in the Pacific and a decision that we are making to care for and have an interest in the welfare, the prosperity, the fate of the countries of the Pacific themselves. And to me, it's not so much about Australian projection as it is about the way in which we can partner with PNG to build their capability. That focus is absolutely critical in terms of getting our policies right in the Pacific.
That is Richard Marles. He's the spokesperson for defence for the Labor Party here in Australia. We will continue to bring you the reaction and developments to that particular story, including hopefully from PNG's current defence commander and also the current defence minister as the day continues. Well, in less than 2 months, the world's most powerful leaders will be in the PNG capital for the APEC summit, meeting behind closed doors in a newly built multi-million dollar convention centre. But out on the streets of Port Moresby and into the regional areas, welfare workers are warning that more and more parents are selling or abandoning their children. Officials and NGOs say it's becoming more common as people flock to urban towns from rural areas and struggle to make ends meet. As Lauren Bell reports.
Just last month, Peter Nepple says he was approached by a woman who wanted him to buy a baby girl from her, aged just 2.5 months.
Then she told me that she was trying to sell a child and then get some money to go over to other places like Lyon, but mostly to reside with some family friends.
The woman was asking for 2,000 kina, but Mr. Nepal bargained her down to 1,500, just over $600 Australian dollars. What she didn't realise was that Peter Nepal is a child protection officer for Western Highlands Province, who called the police under the guise of arranging the money. In May, in the same town of Mount Hagen, Daniel Pomenda says a mother offered him a baby boy for about $400.
She asked me, I'm selling my son. If you want to buy it, then I can sell it for you.
He declined but didn't go to the police. The acting CEO for the Office of Child and Family Services, Simon Yanis, says he knows of two recent cases in the country's capital, Port Moresby, but suspects there are more that simply don't make it to welfare agencies.
There is a trend, increasing trend in sale of children. Particularly the cause of it is rural urban migration and also unexpected pregnancies.
In recent days, he's taken to the media to remind people that the buying and selling of children is illegal.
We are actually now in the process of establishing the National Child Welfare Council.
Informal adoptions in Papua New Guinea, where a child is often cared for by a network of family members under the traditional Wontok system, are fairly common. What's concerning authorities is the sale of children outside of that system by parents or carers who have decided they don't have the resources to look after a child. Tessie Soy, who started the Friends Foundation in Port Moresby to support people living with HIV and AIDS, says she's seeing more HIV-positive children abandoned at hospital.
I believe it's getting worse, and I think it's because of the families are saying to me that their financial situation is not so good.
The sale and abandonment of children puts them at a high risk of further trafficking, forced labour and sexual exploitation. In the latest trafficking report from the US State Department, it noted that the PNG government maintained minimal efforts to prevent trafficking.
That's Lauren Beldy reporting. If you've encountered this situation in PNG at all, you can call the Office of Child and Family Services. That number is 301-0278. Well, the decision by Cook Islands to reopen tenders for companies wanting to explore deep-sea minerals has reactivated debate on seabed mining in the Pacific region in general, as Evan Wasuka reports.
As Cook Islands heads towards reopening its tenders, Papua New Guinea could start deep-sea mining activities in 2019. The Pacific Network on Globalization, PANG, is urging Pacific Island countries to resist the economic allure of deep-sea mining. Deep-sea mining ranges from dredging of the seafloor, which is what is being proposed in Papua New Guinea, to the collection of nodules in deep water as it's being envisaged in Cook Islands. PANG campaigner Joey Tao says countries need more consultation with their people before moving into exploration or activity.
There's a lot of push by multinational corporations, outside partners, pushing the region in terms of seabed mining. But we have a clear position as an organization that has been campaigning on the issue since 2010, and we really call on governments to impose a ban.
Across the region, the Secretariat of the Pacific Community has been working with Pacific Island countries to put together an agreement on deep sea minerals. The draft of the agreement is now with member countries who are reviewing it. It could eventually end up before Pacific leaders at next year's Pacific Island Forum meeting. According to the SPC, the agreement puts in place international standards for deep-sea mining. Aquila Tawaka is the Deputy Director for SPC's Geo-Resources and Energy Department. He says the agreement will be in the best interest of Pacific Island countries.
For them to share information and to work with each other rather than competing or a race to the bottom scenario, we would like to avoid that. The agreement also aligns the Pacific Island countries and territories to international law, for example, the law of the sea, and also in terms of revenue management, the fiscal terms, and how to better manage the revenue emanating from DSM mining ventures, as well as minimum environmental standards and occupational health and safety. So those are some of the areas.
For anti-deep-sea mining campaigners, PANG, the regional agreement is a concern. Mr. Tao says this is part of a push to get more countries to move towards deep-sea mining.
It's a treaty we have reservations about. To carry on from what SPC was doing in terms of having legislative frameworks in place where countries could adapt to have legislation on deep sea mining. We had raised concerns about the type of framework that the SPC had come about. They had lacked processes.
SPC say their work is at the behest of Pacific Island countries and denies that there's pressure on other countries to consider deep sea mining. Mr. Tawake pointed out that SPC was involved in the early stages of the draft, and now a committee, looked after by members of Pacific Island countries, are leading the work on the treaty.
They have appointed a drafting committee, and the chair of the drafting committee is Paul Lynch, the Seabed Minerals Commissioner of the Cook Islands. Now, the role of SPC is only to provide secretarial support.
He says not all Pacific Island countries are interested in deep-sea minerals, and not all have valuable mineral resources. In response to concerns about the potential for environmental damage, Mr. Tawake says the draft agreement covers such issues.
It strongly emphasizes on the minimum environment standards.
For the time being at least, the ball is in the court of individual Pacific Island countries who are being asked to review and to give their blessing to the draft Deep Sea Minerals Regional Agreement.
That's Evan Wasukup reporting.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, uncertainty continues to hang over the long-term future for the people of Vanuatu's volcano-affected Umbai Island, with the national government choosing to once again extend the state of emergency for that area. Umbai's entire population of around 11,000 people had been evacuated two times in the past year, the most recent being in late July and early August, because the island's Manara volcano became more active, spewing large amounts of ash, which had damaged crops and homes and contaminated water supplies. But many people have been hoping that they might be able to return or begin returning later this week when the state of emergency was set to end. For more on the reaction to the announcement, I'm joined by Pacific Beat reporter Nick Fogarty. Nick, firstly, why was the state of emergency extended?
Well, in the last couple of days, the alert level for the Manara volcano has actually been downgraded to level 2 after being at level 3 for quite a few months. But the Geohazards Department is stating that it's still unstable and that there's still considerable ash fall across Umbai Island. While the current state of emergency is set to end this week, the decision was conveyed to the Council of Ministers that a new 2-month state of emergency would begin as soon as this one finishes. That means any decision on allowing someone to travel back to Umbai has to go through the Vanuatu Police.
So what's the reaction of some of the people of Umbai to this news?
Many of them are quite unhappy, although some seem to be taking an attitude of better safe than sorry. I spoke to the head of communications for the Vanuatu Red Cross, Dickinson Tevi, who's been working on Maiwo Island, which is the government's official evacuation point, and on Santo Island. Here's what he took from his interactions with Umbai's evacuees.
There are mixed reactions. We spoke to people on the ground. Some people didn't feel like they wanted to stay longer, while others expressed satisfaction that they feel it's okay to stay a bit longer and wait for the situation on Umbai to be much more safe before they return. So there are mixed feelings about that.
There are now considerable numbers of evacuees relocated in certain villages on Maiwo, including around 150 people in Talisi Village in the south and more than 550 people in Nasawa Village. The Red Cross says while shelter and sanitation are much better than when people first arrived, after inspecting the host communities a few days ago, they say they still have doubts that there are enough safe houses, such as community halls, to accommodate the growing numbers of evacuees. And that's especially important as the cyclone season approaches.
That's our reporter Nick Fogarty. Thanks for the update. Right now, efforts are underway to start cleaning up a massive collection of plastic waste in the Pacific Ocean. It's known as the Great Pacific Garbage Patch and is estimated it's made up as much as 80,000 tonnes of plastic. But the Dutch company behind the new mission, Ocean Cleanup, believes that with its new cleaning system, they're going to be able to bring all that waste to shore and recycle it. Some ocean science experts, though, are critical of the campaign, saying the world's focus should instead be on preventing plastics from reaching oceans at all. And as public attention is drawn to the project, they're also warning that it could be a distraction from the true causes and cures of plastic pollution, as Eugene Yang reports.
How do you clear 1.8 trillion pieces of plastic from the surface of the Pacific Ocean? How do you prevent ocean life from becoming ensnared in old fishing nets or from eating plastic particles? Laurent Le Breton, who is the lead oceanographer at the Ocean Cleanup, believes their systems are the answer.
Basically, that system is a 600-meter long floater that has a 3-meter long skirt, impenetrable skirt underneath. And the idea is to deploy that long barrier into a U-shape that then is moving with currents, waves, and wind. And the idea is to scoop plastic from the surface of the oceans.
Ocean Cleanup's first system launched on September 8, and it's now coming to the end of a 2-week trial designed to ensure it can hold its speed, shape, and strength under harsh ocean conditions. If it passes, it will move on to the Pacific garbage patch, and after that, Mr. Le Breton is clear about Ocean Cleanup's ambitions.
The idea is, if everything goes well with System 1, is to scale up to about 60 systems, and by 2020, hoping to start a cleanup of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which we hope will clean 50% within the next 5 years.
But Dr. Marcus Erickson, co-founder of Five Gyres Institute, whose mission is empowering action on plastic pollution, believes Ocean Cleanup is not understanding and tackling the problem effectively. He says there is no great garbage patch in the ocean, but a smog of tiny microplastic particles that are too small to be captured.
The net array that they deployed, it's not going to capture the microplastics. And that's where I would argue the majority of the harm is coming from, through ingestion of these microparticles.
These microplastics mix with chemicals in the water, potentially harming sea creatures that eat them and the people who consume sea creatures.
That carry that burden of toxicity, that transfer that to the food chain. That's not being addressed by the large array that they're deploying.
Laurent Le Breton agrees that microplastics are the real problem, but he says there is still value in retrieving larger pieces.
And the whole idea of like our mission is basically to collect this before it breaks down into microparticles in time, where then it will be like impossible to pick up.
But Dr. Erickson argues that efforts should be focused on prevention, because oceans already have natural mechanisms to sink or beach bulky debris.
A colleague did a study of boats that were lost to sea after the 2011 Japan tsunami. After 7 years, his modeling predicts that 90% have left the ocean. There are ocean mechanisms that are stranding and sinking and ejecting this large debris over a short period of time.
Beyond the debate over Ocean Cleanup's effectiveness, Jen Kennedy, executive director of the Blue Ocean Society for Marine Conservation, says they should be mindful of their message to the public.
This happens in a lot of situations where people just want this magic solution, which means they don't have to change their behavior or do anything more difficult with their lives. This big cleanup thing is going to happen, and you can keep putting plastic in the ocean, and the ocean cleanup is going to clean it up, and we don't have to worry about it anymore.
But there is one area of general agreement, that preventing plastics from getting into oceans in the first place is a viable solution, and one that is simpler than people might think.
The thing that's always been fascinating to me is it's such an easy thing to do, is just not put your trash on the beach and just choose the right product to buy. It's a problem that should be kind of easily solved compared to a lot of other things like climate change and ocean acidification, which are a lot bigger problems. But this just boils down to individual decisions.
That's Jen Kennedy ending that report from Eugene Yang. Well, it's been 250 years since Captain James Cook set sail headed for the South Pacific on his boat, the Endeavour, for the first of what was to be 3 Pacific voyages he'd make in total, in which he sailed thousands of kilometres mapping land from New Zealand to places like New Caledonia, Vanuatu and Hawaii. And now, more than 2 centuries later, marine archaeologists believe they've also found the wreck of the HMS Endeavour in the United States. But there's another story about the captain that's being told. The Cook and the Pacific exhibition has opened at the Australian National Library. And as Isaac Nauruzzi reports, it offers a fresh perspective on the once somewhat divisive navigator.
He's one of history's most polarising and important figures who sailed all over the world. But now Captain James Cook finds himself at the National Library of Australia.
They'll see a Cook that they haven't seen before, and they'll also see a Pacific that they haven't seen before.
There are handwritten diary entries from all 3 of his Pacific travels. Cook and the Pacific is a voyage into the captain's mind and life.
Cook and the people sailing with him were intensely curious about Pacific language, culture and society, and they recorded language which can now be returned to community.
Most Australians learn about Captain Cook at school, but the lessons differ between generations. This exhibition looks at Cook from different perspectives.
So this gave us the opportunity to explore from the other side of the shore what impressions of Cook were and who was Cook.
The curator spent years travelling across the globe to bring artefacts to the National Library, and with the possible discovery of the HMB Endeavour, there could be more insights to come.
It is looking quite promising. We believe that in 3 to 4 months there should be confirmation of forensic testing of the timbers, and by this time next year we should know for sure, does the Endeavour lie there or doesn't it?
Visitors can channel their inner explorer and join Cook on his voyages.
That's Isaac Nauruzzi reporting there. Well, just a year to go before the 2019 Rugby World Cup in Japan, there's a push for a fairer deal for Pacific teams who've made the cut. A new campaign's being spearheaded by the Pacific Rugby Players Welfare Organisation, which argues that there is uneven rest time between matches, which they say favour the top teams like Australia, England and New Zealand, but don't give Pacific teams enough time to recover, as Richard Hewitt reports.
The chief executive of the Pacific Rugby Players Association, Aidan Clark, acknowledges that the logistics of a Rugby World Cup final series are not easy to manage. But over the years, the Pacific nations have had few of the breaks, and he says it won't be any different in 2019.
I was having a good chat with John McKee, Fiji coach, the other dinner, about one of their 5-day turnarounds. Saturday game, travel Sunday, light training run, captain's run and then player game. So not ideal at all if you're looking to improve in between games.
And the impact of short game breaks can be telling. The former Tonga captain Inoki Afiaki can vouch for that based on his experience of playing Canada at the World Cup in 2003.
Canada's game plan was to stay there for the full 80. We played exceptionally well in the first half. We had a ton of opportunity to score points in the second half, but we were tired. We couldn't link up to play a game that you should have about a week's rest to get the body ready. So yes, that was one that definitely hurt us.
Bob Ross again, it's a training ground move. Winston Stanley gets it wide. It should be a try in the corner. And Canada scored through Sean Forth. It was brilliantly orchestrated.
Players find it hard. We're talking about the elite of rugby here, the pinnacle of the sport. And to not have an opportunity for the body to recoup, especially after these extremely physical games, makes it really tough for one team versus another who's had a longer rest period.
World Rugby tried to even things up at the last World Cup by giving the Tier 1 teams at least one short turnaround. But the editor of Rugby World magazine, Gregor Paul, says it was a half-hearted attempt to solve the problem.
But when you looked at it, the All Blacks ended up with 2 games in the first 5 days at the World Cup. Then they had an 8-day break, and then they had another 7-day break. Whereas Fiji ended up playing all 4 of their games in something like 17 days. It wasn't equitable, but World Rugby were trying to claim by having shortened up one of the timeframes for the top teams that was fixing things.
One solution to the unevenness of the World Cup draw would be to increase the size of the tournament. But Tonga's coach, Toto Kefu, says now is not the time for expansion, tempting though that might be for World Rugby.
The Rugby World Cup is their number one cash cow, and I know if they deliver a really good product, a competitive product, they're only just going to make more money. I think we've got the right number for now, but I suppose those teams from 15 to 25 rank, once they get a little bit more competitive, sure, I think they need to really look at expanding the competition.
Let's get Tier 2 structures in terms of high performance a bit better, so they've got better training facilities where they've got more resources available to them in terms of physiotherapy, gym access. You watch what the All Blacks have or what England Rugby have, and it's amazing how well looked after these guys are. Why don't we just stop for a second and try and fix the 3 years and 11 months between the World Cups and get a far more stable structure in there so that these teams can go to a World Cup and have far more of an impact.
Tonga, at least, do have a reasonable draw for 2019, but Toti Kefu says it all comes down to chance.
We're doing all right. We've got a 6 days and then 3 7-day turnaround. We're lucky.
Fiji and Samoa, though, haven't been lucky again. But as is so often the case in the Pacific sporting world, Aidan Clark says the players from the islands just get on and play with the cards they are dealt.
The unfortunate thing is that Pacific Island teams are used to dealing with the adversity of this now, which is not a good thing. But the guys have almost got an attitude of, oh, this is the stick that we get handed, let them make the most of it.
And make the most of it they will, I'm sure. That's Aidan Clark, the chief executive of the Pacific Rugby Players Association. The reporter there was Richard Hewitt. And if you're keen on listening back to that story, if you want to share it perhaps with your family and friends, you can do so via our website. It's going to be up there shortly. To find it, you just need to search for Pacific Beat and Radio Australia in your search engine and you'll be able to find it that way. You can also find our stories via Facebook if you prefer that. You might just want to follow the Radio Australia page so that our stories show up in your feed. I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks so much for your company this morning.